You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist-inspired radio brought to you by CKUT and the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy. The Dragon Root has two genders and symbolizes the diversity of every body and every mind on the gender spectrum. Tune in every Tuesday morning from 8:39 on 90.3 FM or ckut.ca/listen. You can also pick up and choose from our archives at center2110.org. We bring you reports from the Blueprint Radio Project on gendered violence, live tunes from feminists, queer, trans, and gender-aware musical guests, and interviews about a wide array of social justice issues examined through a gender-perceptive lens. Today on Dragon Root, Judith Butler received an honorary degree from McGill University last week on May 29th. The Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at McGill organized a reception for Butler, where she spoke to the crowd on her thoughts on how language and gender collide. A post-structuralist philosopher and academic in feminist, queer, and political theory, she has written a number of thought-provoking works, including Gender Trouble, Feminism and the Subversion of Identity, Undoing Gender, and Excitable Speech, A Politic of the Performative. Here's Judith Butler speaking at the McCord Museum on May 29th.
I thought it might be interesting just to talk about the travels of gender for a brief moment. And I think I say this in the piece, when Gender Trouble was first proposed to be translated into French, the publisher Fayard said it was an inassimilable, which is, of course, the word used for unwanted migrants. And then, you know, other people in Paris, mainly, you know, in about three, you know, the three arrondissements which speak for France. well, it's true. I mean, because of the French, it's like, you mean the fifth, sixth, or maybe, you know, some part of either the fourth or the seventh. Anyway. But others say, oh, it's the McDonaldization of the French Academy, or something terrible. And then, of course, gender became something that you could say in French, which was very interesting, and especially hearing people say gender. And there was gender studies. And they even established a couple of chairs in gender studies, which was fabulous. And, you know, with some pride, I think. Although there were other people who thought, no, let's keep femininity in relationship to gender, or let's keep la différence sexuelle in relationship to gender, or, you know, different ways of handling that. Différence des sexes seemed to be different from différence sexuelle and gender. Anyway, it was hard to track, but I saw that there were many different things going on. And of course, also queer studies has had a harder time taking hold in that particular place, and a hard time in Germany, and a very hard time in many other places. But it's a term that disrupts some of the more disciplinary or institutional ways we have of organizing knowledge, and suggests that we can't just take sexuality as a simple problem of identity, but as something that comes in diverse forms and interrupts various forms of life that may not seem to be that may not seem to pertain to sexuality on the face of it. And the organization of politics, the organization of kinship, the organization of time, of generational thinking, of the couple, of sociability and intimacy and passion and sexuality and love. Like, can we really do a good job thinking about any of those things without all of those categories and some queer ones as well? So, you know, I think that disruptive effect is felt, and sometimes it's resisted. but it's an important kind of development, and it's also one that kind of raises the question of what's the relationship between an academic field and even a discipline and a broader social movement, or a broader set of social movements. How do they inform each other? How do they resonate with one another? In my view, it's not the task of the academic to prescribe what a social movement should do. That's a form of kind of intellectual elitism or at worst social engineering that I don't really approve of. But I do think it's important for academics to move in and out of their more closed institutional spaces in order to find out what's happening and to allow what's happening to register in academic language and institution making and unmaking. So there is a kind of obligation to move among registers and to be someone who is not one place or another exclusively, but who takes on the task of translation, because that's sometimes precisely what has to happen, going into popular audiences and trying to explain what certain academic concepts are, or moving back into the academy and trying to say what is really happening on the street or in popular struggles or in the midst of demonstrations, and allowing oneself to be something like a vector or I wouldn't call it a translation machine, but I think, you know, there's a problem of translation that is happening all the time for those of us who are thinking these fields in relationship to broader social and political movements and phenomena. The last thing I thought I might say here is just the following, that in the gay marriage debates, and I'm sorry to use France as my reference right now, there are other places I could use, but it's been in the news, as you know, especially recently because of the gay marriage legislation that has passed and some of the violent demonstrations that ensued. And what I wanted to say there is that there were many people, like in Lille, for instance, there was a demonstration contre genre, against gender. And I was trying to think, what does it mean to be against gender? What does it mean to be for gender? Or is it a kind of, you know, football team? You know, is it, I don't know, even, is it a flag that one waves? I mean, I don't really understand contre genre. And it seems to me that what they were saying is that the term gender has allowed for people to think about the cultural variability of how people are embodied. In other words, they can become trans, they can shift their morphology, they can transition from female to male or from female to trans, or they can transition out of those categories into some other space that they may name in a different way. So part of it was to say we've gone too far, there's too much freedom and excess and variability, and what we need to do is bring all that back to biological male and biological female reference, and to build social institutions on the basis of those clear, binary, mutually exclusive reference. But being contre genre also meant, or means apparently, to be against things like gay marriage or adoption for people who are outside of heterosexual marriage, and that includes, you know, all kinds of people who may be in gay couples or maybe out of gay couples or maybe in complex kinship arrangements or maybe single women, not two of a man, maybe two men, maybe one man. Poor guy, one man. It's like, oh boy, that is the impulsand. So if we think about that, well, what is parenting, the rights to parent, or even like being a good parent? What does that have to do with what kind of sexual arrangement you're in? Whether you're married, whether you're coupled, whether you're heterosexual, bisexual, whether you have a complex life that none of us really need to hear about. Right? You've got like a long story that goes, you know, whatever. It seems to me that when people gather to be against gender, they were also gathering to be against gay marriage and gay adoption, or the access to reproductive technology for people who are outside of established heterosexual marriages. And that means that gender then signifies something like new organizations of kinship. It signifies something like the separation between marital status and parenting rights, something that in many states and in several countries is already established in law. And established causal sequence is interrupted. Okay, you are a certain biological sex. Your sexuality must be or should be heterosexual. The social form that heterosexuality should take is marriage, and the having of a child should be restricted to a procreative privilege exercised within the context of established heterosexual marriage. Wow, who can do all that? You know, that's all. I mean, some people easily do it, and it's a great pleasure for them. I'm very pleased to know that that works. and they do it with some ease, or maybe some ambivalence that they can manage. But the idea that we should all kind of be railroaded into that one trajectory seems really hard, because people do have questions about their biological sex and the one they were assigned, and how they feel about that assignment, and whether they're willing to accept that assignment. That's part of what I think you read in the piece that I gave you today. What does it mean to be from the beginning called a certain sex, and also to be gendered? I mean, already to be called a sex is part of gendering, because people are going to call it in a certain way, and they're going to mean something by it, and that's going to be communicated. So we're already in a kind of cultural realm there. But a whole lot of other people, like I may have totally clear, unequivocal sense of what my sex is, but that doesn't mean that my desire follows from that in some way, some predictable way. What would that even be? And, you know, it used to be the case that in psychiatry, if you were a man and you desired another man, that meant you were passive and actually then feminine. The only problem with that is that the man you desired probably wouldn't be feminine. But if he was feminine, he would also be a woman, which means that every homosexual man is a lesbian. Right? There's no way to actually get passive and active together over there. And similarly, if you're a woman and you wanted another woman, you were aggressive or active or masculine, and if she also happened to be a lesbian, she was too, which meant that you were guys together. So, you know, the thinking outside of the heterosexual box has been extremely hard to do, and I see the new DSM has made great changes. It's already, in the last 15 years, 20 years, a number of psychologists and psychiatrists have really worked hard to open up those categories and depathologize many of these movements. But there's a whole lot more work to do, and it's one of these areas like kinship and marriage and parenting and psychiatry, all of them are linked with what we do in the academy. We think about those phenomena that are given to us to think, and we make certain kinds of interventions, and sometimes we even get lucky enough to be cited in their legal briefs or in the American Psychiatric Association. That's a good thing. Finally, I just wanted to say that gender is not a universal, you know. I work on it a lot. I have worked on it a lot. It's a term that's really crucial to my own thinking, but probably because I came through a certain language and read sociology and anthropology of a certain time and was working with that lexicon. But as I've traveled, or as I've confronted the way in which my own work or other work in feminist and queer theory has been translated in different countries, I find that comes up against real impasses. And not because everybody is committed to biological sex understood in a certain way, but because the term gender is sometimes not even a term. Sometimes it's it only comes about as the inflection of a verb. It doesn't have substantial place in the language other than the inflection of I refer to you, or I refer to something else, or I refer to myself. Then in those modes of reference, gender emerges, but it's not a thing. And it can't be understood as an object or a substance that can be analyzed separately from the relationships in which it's lived. And if there's something kind of more or less general that I could say about gender, I would want to say that it is relational, and that it works in language and it works in institutions in ways that are sometimes quite explicit and sometimes quite implicit. But one gets treated a certain way, or one speaks a certain way, or one is spoken to a certain way, and it emerges in the context of those kinds of interactions. You're not included. No one ever speaks your name in a certain context. No one ever assumes you might be part of a group. That also can be gender. Deafening silence can be the attribution of gender, can be the presence of gender. So it seems to me that gender studies can't market itself to every culture and every instance. It has to figure out what the problem of translation is, and actually sometimes let its vocabulary go in the name of understanding better how these kinds of issues are approached in different ways and in different languages. And so it's not an ideology that needs to market itself as such. It's a particular vocabulary that emerges from several times and spaces, and it comes up against certain kinds of blocks, and that's terribly important to allow that to happen and to learn from that and to revise our understanding of how language and power works accordingly. The only other thing I guess I would add, and maybe this is a bit more theoretical, is simply that it's not just that gender doesn't translate into some languages, and it does not. But gender is really hard to translate at all, because calling someone a gender, or being called a gender, or being treated as a gender, it is enigmatic. There's something enigmatic. What is expected of me? What does this term want of me? I was in a hotel room last week in London, and a gentleman came and knocked on the door, and I was very busy, and he said, excuse me, I'm here to check the minibar. Excuse me, Mr. Madam, Mr. Madam, Mr. Madam, Mr. Madam, Mr. Madam, like that. And I could tell he couldn't stop. He was just panicked. He was panicked. So he got more rigid. Mr. Madam, Mr. Madam. I saw it was really obligatory that I intervene and try to handle the anxiety. And I was a little bit irascible, and I said, let me ask you something. Is it really important to determine my gender in order to check the minibar? And he was like, and then, of course, the problem is he was so polite that he said, of course not, Mr. Madam. You could say it was a kind of cruelty on my part, not to have alleviated his anxiety, but for some reason I was feeling kind of truculent, and I wasn't able to do it. Although, I guess feeling bad about it, the next day I was in a swimming pool in the same hotel, and I was getting dressed, and a woman came in. I think I was mainly dressed, and a woman and her friend came in, young woman, and she said, I think I must be in the wrong place here. And she said, let's go ask. And she said, do the ladies and the blokes both change in here? And I said, no. And then I realized she was really freaked out. And I think I was feeling guilty about the other guy. So I just said, I'm a lady. And she looked at me. It was the first time in my life I've ever said that. you just get, you know, it's like, oh my God, I can't stand her. So I just like handed it to her. I said, I'm a lady. You know, at least I'll have a story to tell, which I told. Anyway, you can see sometimes it's easier and sometimes it's less easy to inhabit such categories or to be inhabited by them. I think they're complex social institutions. They do produce a lot of anxiety, which is part of what we've seen on the streets in these demonstrations against gender, against that form of anxiety, against that form of aggression, against the fearful prospect that people may not be what they seem or they might be in the course of.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM's Tuesday Morning After. You just heard Judith Butler speak at the McCord Museum on May 29th at the reception of her honorary degree. Special thanks to the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at McGill for organizing the ceremony. Tune in next week for more reports on gender-based issues with Dragon Root Radio. We'll be right back.